From the Clark Ford Studio in Oxford, Mississippi, MBW Digital proudly presents the Oxford Exxon Podcast.
I'd say thanks for tuning in, but why am I going to give you a round of applause for something that you're supposed to do, to be frank?
And now, here are your hosts, Chase Palm.
And broadcast school has really paid off.
And Neil McCready.
I deserve to be on TV.
Wednesday edition of the Oxford Exxon Podcast. Chase Palm, Neil McCready, coming to you in different places again. It's been a mainstay the last couple weeks. We've been taking some days, and then also SEC Media Day this week in Atlanta again. The first year, and going back to Hoover next year, but in Atlanta this year. So Ole Miss goes yesterday. We'll discuss that a good bit. A lot of coverage at RebelGrove.com, and a couple interviews coming your way today as well. We're going to talk to Tommy Dees. He's the executive sports editor of the Tuscaloosa News. He's been with us, I feel like, this week on the podcast for the last couple of years, entertaining guy, about 20 minutes or so with Tommy. And then Mark Passwaters, who covers Texas A&M for Rivals.com. He will discuss Jimbo Fisher and more today on the show as well. You'll get interviews the rest of the week. Also from SC Media Days on the Billy's Pecans Hotline, and the podcast brought to you every single day by the Oxford Exxon, Highway 6 West in Oxford. Tell you about going next door to the Oxford Crystal, though. Because when you do that, you get the pimento cheese bites. You get pimento and cheese on your crystal if you so choose. Those are new. They're very good. So give them a try there at the Oxford Crystal on Highway 6 West. And again, at least I am in the Clark Ford studio.
And Clark Ford's in Amory, Mississippi. The phone number is 662-257-1900. Call that number. Ask for Corey Clark. Tell Corey what new Ford you are looking for, and he will send you a quote within 15 minutes in business hours. It's that simple. There's no hassle. There's no haggling. It's right to the bottom line. It is a really easy way to do your automotive shopping. You're going to get that quote, and then you can decide where you go from there. You can shop that quote if you'd like, or you can go ahead and take that bottom line deal from Corey and the people at Clark Ford. Let them take the hassle out of the everyday car buying experience. I've done it. What you get with it is a great Ford vehicle, phenomenal service after the sale, and no headache, just ease there at Clark Ford, and we'll make it even better at the end of your deal. Tell Corey that you heard about Clark Ford on the podcast, any of our family of podcasts. It's $500 off the bottom line. Clark Ford and Amory, 662-257-1900.
So obviously pretty much the same setup, but has Media Day been just like every other Media Day, or are there some differences now that it is away from the Winfrey?
It's better. It's more, it's easier. The Omni Hotel is right next to the College Football Hall of Fame. They've got the TV and radio people in the Omni. They've got the print/internet people in the College Football Hall of Fame. They've got much more control of the fans. Now, today will be the interesting day because today Alabama goes and their fan base is the crazies. But it's not in Alabama, so there will be fewer of them. It has, how do I say this? It has attracted a different kind of fan.
So you've seen fans.
You can see them, yeah, because they have to get a fan pass.
Oh.
And they can stand along kind of a corridor area. It looked,
for the most part, pretty calm and normal, best I could tell yesterday.
It's attracted more like dad and a couple of his – a couple of children kind of thing. It's just made it a little more professional, frankly. It's less crowded, even though there's more media. And this thing's going to go back to Hoover next year, Chase, and then it's never going back to Hoover again. They're going to make this. They want to make this an event. They're determined to make this an event. Never's a big word. I think their goal is to never take it back to Hoover after next year.
So Ole Miss goes yesterday, and best I could tell, I've watched a good bit, I've read a lot. Players represented the Rebels well. Nothing went outrageous. Nothing went really negative. And for Ole Miss, you know, likable and boring was pretty much what you wanted out of a day, and I think the Rebels hit that on most accounts yesterday morning.
I mean, yesterday they were Ole Miss was kind of an afterthought, and for right now that's a good thing. Ole Miss was kind of boring and kind of vanilla and not a hot topic of conversation, and for right now that's probably a good thing. You don't want to stay that way for long. You don't want to become Vanderbilt, but for right now, that's probably a good thing. There was no talk of buying players and cheating and all of that stuff other than apparently on the SEC network, which, again, I don't watch. People get worked up about Marcus Spears and things that he says and stuff like that. I don't watch that stuff. So I get, and I'm sure you do too, I get messages, what's his deal? I don't know. I don't find that show entertaining, honestly. I don't. So I don't watch it. So I don't know what they're saying. You know, along those lines, I mean, the only news yesterday was a statement by Bruce Lloyd, the attorney for Barney Farrar, that intimated that Farrar's hearing, and I presume the entire hearing in front of the committee on the appeals committee begins today. That's really all that's left. There was a lot of, you know, there's questions still of players that were there, Sean Rawlings, Josiah Coatney, Jordan Tamu, about, and Matt Lewis, you know, motivation without a bowl game. And their answer a year ago was sort of a stock answer, a cliche answer that it didn't matter. But, you know, they proved last year that that wasn't a great big deal. And it's like I said on a radio show in Memphis yesterday, I've never got the sense that not getting to say go to the Independence Bowl or the Music City Bowl or the Birmingham Bowl or whatever was a real big deal. I didn't really think that mattered a lot. I didn't think that impacted their season, their motivation for the season. In fact, they played better at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. There just wasn't a lot of news coming away from Ole Miss, and people liked the kids. The young men, they're all likable, well spoken. Matt Luke was in his, I thought he did a really good job in his first appearance in the big room. His opening statement was about 2 minutes, and which is perfect. And he took some questions, and you know, he's not going to be the fiery, excited guy in that room. He's not going to be the most entertaining guy in that room. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. Matt's genuine. He's likable. I think he came across that way. I think the narrative on Ole Miss with media has begun to change. Now, does that matter? Not really. It shouldn't. The one thing I thought was interesting yesterday, maybe the only thing that I thought was interesting in Matt Luke's comments, he was asked a question about Philip Fulmer, who, of course, is the Tennessee athletics director and a former head coach there, who took over the Tennessee job as an interim coach after being the offensive line coach. And so there was obviously a parallel, and Matt Luke worked for Phil Fulmer for 2 seasons at Tennessee. And Matt gave an answer about his mentors in coaching. And he talked about a number of people, obviously Fulmer, David Cutcliffe. He mentioned Ed Orgeron as someone who he learned about the recruiting side of it. I thought he was very specific with that answer. If I recall, he even mentioned Joe Panunzio, who he worked for initially at Murray State. He did not mention Hugh Freeze at all. No one mentioned Hugh Freeze at all. There were some comments even from players that really supported my theory, which is that team last year that went 6-6, I don't think they go 6-6 had it been Hugh Freeze as the head coach. I think his message and his messaging had not only gotten stale inside that program, I think it had become an irritant inside that program.
Yeah, no, they no doubt played, I'd say harder, but you know what I mean, for Matt and Hugh. Things were better in the locker room than they would have been. There's no doubt about that. You know what? It's funny. You mentioned all this, and we've talked about Matt being really good with injury reports at the start of press conferences, different things. For an inexperienced head coach, he hits so many things right with the media. I mean, you don't mention Hugh Freeze because there's no reason to put that word out of your mouth to allow other people to use it in theirs. So that was a really good move on his part. And look, wins are going to decide this thing. But as far as like the cherries and the nuts on the sundae for the media stuff, he's really, really, really good in a short period of time where I think he has an understanding on how to help, but then also things that can be hindrances to avoid. He shows a better knack for that than a lot of college coaches that, frankly, have been doing this a whole lot longer.
Yeah, I agree. And he, at no point last year, I was really, and I remember writing this when I did not believe he was going to get the job after they lost to Texas A&M. I frankly assumed they would lose to Mississippi State and had sourcing to indicate that Matt was not getting the job, as you know. And I remember writing that I don't know that I could have stayed as level-headed and as calm with media as he did last year. I think he recognized, and maybe begrudgingly, maybe not, I don't know. I haven't discussed it with him, and I doubt if I ever will. I think he recognized that most of us were just doing our jobs. We're not. When you as a coach decide that you're going to make the media your enemy, it's an error. Media is not going to determine whether you succeed or fail. When you're a head coach at that level, you're in the scoreboard business. You're absolutely in the scoreboard business. And the people, if you're fighting with the media, you're fighting with people who have no impact whatsoever, positively or negatively, on the scoreboard.
If you go 3-9, all the media in the world is not going to help you. And if you go 10-3, there's not a media in the world that's going to hurt you.
Exactly. I mean, you know, outside of stuff that's going on, you know, on the periphery of your program.
Well, of course.
You know, and even then, that stuff's on you as a coach. I mean, it's your program. I mean, media can't but they typically don't make up scandal. The media didn't cause the NCAA investigation. I don't know. It was, if I'm an Ole Miss fan, yesterday was somewhat of a palate cleanser. Wasn't particularly exciting. And you want to get back to being a headliner. But I think for a year or two, it might not be the worst thing in the world to have a lower profile.
Yeah, it was a good day. You got some headlines. People seem to really like Jordan Tamu. Sean Rawlings did a nice job. Josiah Coatney gave a couple quotes that people have kind of pointed out. Everybody kind of did their jobs yesterday in the way that they should have been done. And then you just kind of move on. At the end of the day, they are in this transition period still from a national media standpoint, and you need to win some games at this point. Only thing really, as you mentioned, no Hugh Freeze. The only thing rivalry yesterday was Dan Mullen, being Dan Mullen that we know and love at times from a content perspective, discussing healthy rivalries that he's currently in now and is glad he's out of that unhealthy one. Yeah, Dan, you had nothing to do with that whatsoever.
Yeah, that was a disingenuous.
It's so stupid.
Statement on his part. I've seen some people say he was the only person that elevated that rivalry, and that's just not true. He was one of the first people to make that rivalry nasty.
He lit the fuse.
He did. He lit the fuse, but there was plenty of fuel poured on that thing from both sides. Matt Luke was asked about that rivalry yesterday. He gave the stock answer about it's always going to be a big game. I don't sense, and you were one of the first people to say this, I don't sense that either Matt Luke or Joe Moorhead are going to turn the burner up on the rivalry. I sense that there is detente, if you will, as much as there can be. You know, it needs to have the heat turned down. It's not healthy. It's been remarkably unhealthy, and I think it's I think it's had a negative impact on the way people view both schools. I really do. I don't. That's nasty. And it's been damaging. It's been more damaging to Ole Miss, obviously, than Mississippi State. But I still think the day comes down the road, and it might be way down the road, where I think Leo Lewis speaks the truth about what happened and how it happened.
You
and
think
when
so,
he does,
yeah.
It won't. I do, and it won't be a good look. Yeah, because he's going to lose the spotlight when he finishes play. And I don't know about lawsuits and Terry Warren's lawsuit and all that stuff. And I'm frankly not particularly interested. But I do think when Leo Lewis is no longer a guy getting the applause on Saturday afternoons, and he has to start to deal with some of the ramifications of what he did, and there's no one there to support him because those people used him and they've all sort of moved on, I think he'll speak out.
The absolute least surprising thing of yesterday in Dan Mullen was he gave the quote that it was, quote, a very easy decision to leave Mississippi State and become the head coach at Florida. That appeared to ruffle some feathers and create some animosity, but number one, duh, he was going to say that, and number two, yes, duh, it was an easy decision.
Yeah, of course it was an easy decision. He'd been trying to get out for 2 years, minimum. He hired Jimmy Sexton to get out.
It's amazing the number of people that put head in sand about what that meant when he hired Jimmy. You know what I mean? And it was because they wanted to, but my gosh.
Well, I mean, I talked to someone. Oh, got to be careful. I talked to someone yesterday who would know, who just talked about the media core that covers that program. And look, I'm going to keep this real. We can't on our beat cast many aspersions. It's our beat was not a great look yesterday. But when you have people that only consume propaganda, you can't be shocked when they believe that propaganda. I mean, Dan Mullen wanted out. Of course he wanted out. Give Dan Mullen credit. I do. Dan Mullen played the coaching carousel perfectly last year. It helped that he had the best agent in the world, in Jimmy Sexton. But he played it perfectly last year. He Tennessee wanted him. He used the Tennessee interest to force Florida's hand. And Florida hired Dan Mullen probably before it really wanted to, because it couldn't risk letting Dan Mullen get away and then not getting who it wanted. Credit to him. He's at a better program. By any way that you judge programs, Florida is a better program than Mississippi State. There's a higher ceiling. There's more money. There's more prospects. There's more potential. There's all of those things. And he's the head coach at Florida. And he used Mississippi State as a springboard to get there. And whether you love Dan Mullen or hate him, and I know more people listening to this fall into the latter category than the former, you have to give him credit for getting himself into that spot. Because a lot of people said when he took the job at Mississippi State that it was a dead-end deal, that you could never get out of there. He did. He's now the head coach at Florida. I'll give him at least credit for being honest about saying it was an easy decision. It was an absolute no-brainer.
Where is that day? Those two teams play in Starkville in late September. On a scale of 1 being a standing ovation to 10 being Houston Nutt's return to Fayetteville, where is this going to fall on the scale?
Closer to Houston Nutt's return to Fayetteville.
Yeah.
They're angry at him for saying that. It's an inability to be real over there. It's simple as that.
I know you wrote about this a little bit before we go to Tommy in a second. What did Matt say as far as Jefferson and incoming players and that kind of thing?
Jefferson and Tisdale just have not gotten their academics in order yet. Everybody else was there to – those are the two that he mentioned specifically that they were waiting on. And he really didn't delve into details about the specifics of their situations. There was that. I'm trying to think of things that were newsworthy. I think if you know how to read coach speak, you came away feeling like Devon Penniman's probably not playing this year. He tried to tell us that without making it a definite thing. And I thought his answer about the linebacker core, about the ability to stop the run, I thought it was interesting. I thought it was interesting on a number of levels. He eventually mentioned some linebackers, but it was way down into the answer. He talked about being creative with their secondary to ways to kind of stack the box, force teams to throw. They're going to count on those corners, Jalen Jones, Ken Webster, to be able to hold up against those deep throws. I thought it was a challenge of sorts that was issued to Wesley McGriff, frankly. He didn't say his name, but he intimated that they're going to have to get creative and stop the run. Matt, to his credit, it's cliche, but, man, this cliche is real. And Matt played in this league. He's coached in this league at different schools. If you can't run the football and you can't stop the run, Chase, you're not winning in this league. And there's a book of history to support that. And so while it's cliche, it's true. And Matt said it yesterday. There's this whole thing of that they're going to get off the bus. You're going to hear Tommy Dees talk about how Ole Miss is going to get off the bus throwing the football. And they are, but Ole Miss was good last year when it had a quarterback running the system and when it had a running back who was a threat to keep defenses honest, where you could get some one-on-one matchups with big physical wide receivers like Brown and Metcalf and Lodge. If defenses don't think you can run the football and they don't stack the box, they can play a lot of zones and cover twos and all of those things, and they're not going to stop Brown and Metcalf and those kind of people, but they can negate them. They can limit them. And those are the two areas. It's very simple football. Football's, everybody tries to make it complicated. At the end of the day, it's about running, being able to run the football. He seemed high on Scottie Phillips. I thought that was what was interesting. When he was asked about the offensive side of this, which is running the football, his answer was more hopeful than when he was asked about the defensive side, and he referred to it as the elephant in the room. There's concern there. And that's why people like you and me who are around the program and cover it, I think that's why we are a lot more cautious with our predictions and such than maybe fans who just get excited about, and I'm not knocking fans, but fans who just get excited about the possibilities through the air on the offensive side of the ball. I think we've seen enough football to deep down know that if you cannot be balanced and you can't stop the run and get off the field, it's just really hard. That your margin of error to win games gets really thin.
Yeah, you run when you have to. It's not about 50-50, but it's about late in the game when you need the 3 or 4 yards. That's when you have to do it. So anyway, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll go to Tommy Dees of the Tuscaloosa News. Take a break in this podcast. Tell you the name to know in Memphis real estate is Stacy Berry, a Keller Williams agent who's looking to help you find your special place to call home, whether it's downtown, midtown, Germantown, or Collierville. Keller Williams is the number one real estate agency in the world, number one in agents, units sold, and volume sold. And the Berry home team is now an integral part of that world-renowned brand. If you're a first-time home buyer looking to downsize, Stacy will evaluate and determine your current home value and sell it quickly for top dollar. So if you're looking to sell a home, buy a home, or invest in real estate, call the Berry home team today and let Stacy unlock Memphis for you. You can reach her at 901-481-6420. Stacy Lane Berry at KW.com. That's Stacy with an E, LAINE, Berry at KW.com. Or check it out, theberryhometeam.com. The podcast also brought to you by Mastercuts Lawn and Landscape, 662-607 7773 is the number to give MasterCuts a call and let them help you out, whether it's building an outdoor living area, outdoor kitchen area, or just take care of your yard all year long with weed eating, edging, and mowing. They do that for me all the time. They are excellent. And tell them you heard about the podcast. They might cut you a deal there as well. 662-607-7773. Podcast also brought to you by Locker Stockers. Take the hassle out of stocking your locker or your suite this football season. A new thing set up to help you, the customer, really takes the hassle out of something that you might have to go and fit a time period, wait in line a little bit to get in. Instead, they handle the purchase and delivery of the locker or the products to the locker or suite before game day. They're also going to help give you an early sign-up special with a 10% discount on a season package if you sign up before August 1st, 662-586-1487. Or email info@lockerstockers.com for information. And the podcast is also brought to you by Community Mortgage, Oxford, Memphis, Soto County, and Chattanooga. Our underwriting and processing is done in Memphis. You're getting local underwriting, understands your market, a leader in condo financing, and the float down option. So you can find Jason at 662-234-2704 or JLo at communitymtg.com.
Tommy Dees of the Tuscaloosa News joins here. Nick Saban goes for national championship number 700 over the last 6 years. I like his chances. Let's take a step back. Last season, Nick Saban wins a national title with his best quarterback not playing until the second half of the national championship game. What does that say for the program that he's built in Tuscaloosa?
I think it's typical of most every position, and the backup is good, and the backup is good. You know, it was really more illustrated by the number of linebackers who went down, and all at once and all early. So it wasn't like one guy came back and another guy went down. When you lose four linebackers who you were counting on in the first game, and you still are able to pretty much put FSU away, we know they didn't turn out to be as good as a lot of people thought, and the quarterback got hurt. And then you just keep going through the schedule, and, you know, some of those guys didn't come back till the very end of the season. And, you know, you got guys like Jamie Mosley, you know, whose brother's in the NFL, but who was a walk-on, a preferred walk-on, a three-star kind of walk-on. But, you know, he's out there performing for you. And, you know, if you look at the pieces out there, that was really more scheme than all athletic ability. There was also a couple of young guys who stepped up, but they were not the same defense that they had been the year before. Now, toward the end, they got back to that, but they did it a little more with the offense and ball control, and he just adjusts to whatever happens. So I think he's got the pieces on the table that he can move around, and not everybody has all those pieces. And as you saw with the quarterback thing, you know, the interesting thing, and I'm not really answering your question probably, the interesting thing to me about that was, is Georgia scored with 30 seconds left in the first half to make it 13-0. If it's 6-0 going into halftime, I don't think he makes a change, would you? He's come back from that, you know, and you just figure your defense will keep you in the game, and your guy's going to make a play or two like he has. And that score with 30 seconds left was the impetus to Alabama making a change at quarterback and winning the national championship.
Did you think at that moment, I know in hindsight we all know that he didn't, did you think at that moment that he would do it, make the change from Hurts to Tagovailoa?
The whole halftime discussion I had with every member of the press that I talked to is he going to pull the trigger? You know, there have been rumors that he might play against Clemson. Turned out they didn't really need to make a change there and kept with Jalen. And a lot of us thought, okay, so much about for that. But we could all see it possibly coming. But that was kind of like, you know, that onside kick against Clemson in the national championship a couple of years before where, you know, does he have the minerals to really make that bold a move at halftime of the national championship game? It's not like you're down 27-0. What do you got to lose? You know, when he made the change and Jake Coker, you know, came in against Ole Miss and ended up winning the job in a losing game, they were so far behind at that point, it wasn't like rolling the dice. Jake Coker probably didn't come in at that point and stay in if it's a 7-point game, and it was the same year. But he wanted to win the game, and he thought that was his best chance, and it turned out it was.
You've covered a lot of great Alabama games, a lot of dramatic games. Where does that one rank where the game, national championship goes to overtime? It's a SEC opponent. It's a guy, it was his defensive coordinator for, 8 years or 7 years, 8 years. In terms of drama inside that building, where does that one rank?
Yeah, the three that I think of that I've covered, and two of them have been under Nick Saban, was the Georgia game for the SEC championship, which was a national championship game. Whoever won that was going to destroy Notre Dame. And Alabama won kind of a Donnybrook, just back and forth slugfest, and took it over. Then you got that one, and I don't know how you top, you know, second and 26 in overtime in a game where you don't even have a kicker. So, you know, you can't say, well, just kick the field goal and tie it and play some more. You're probably not going to make that field goal. You missed a chip shot at the end of the regulation, so you got to score a touchdown, and then you get a 16-yard sack on the first play, and it's over. And the next play, it's not. So that's the most dramatic finish. And then I go way back, and I think this might have been a Mike Dubose era. I'd have to go look. I can't really remember. Might have even been late Stallings. But they came back from 17 down at LSU in the fourth quarter in a game, scored 21 unanswered points, and that involved an unlikely onside kick that took a really weird bounce. That one third by far of the other two. And I would have to say, with the stakes, with the drama, with the you know, overtime, then you would have to say that the Georgia one. But there's been some good games against LSU, repeated good games.
Yeah. You know? Let's look ahead a little bit. Obviously, the last image that we had of Alabama was the second and 26 to win the national title. That was probably a throw that Jalen Hurts can't make. Tua made it, made lots of throws like that. I would assume he's the guy, right? I know that they haven't declared a quarterback, but and he had some injuries in the spring, but as you get ready for fall camp, do you anticipate that it's his job to lose?
I don't, because of the fact that he really didn't participate in the spring. And you've always heard that you can't lose your job, starting job, due to injury. You damn sure can't win it due to injury just by default. But you're just not that he chose to sit out, but because he was injured and had to sit out, I think you reset the competition. Ultimately, I think if I had to, if you gave me $20 to bet on who's going to take the first snap in the first game, I'd probably put 15 of it in my back pocket and not tell you, and put 250 each. If you want to ask me who's going to take the first snap in the last game, my money's more likely to be on Tua. I think he's the guy that over time will prove, barring injury, and he was hurt in the spring. Here's an interesting fact for you that you don't hear much, and eventually will when it happens, but Alabama hasn't had a starting quarterback miss a start due to injury since Brody Croyle in the early 2000s. That's like a 15, 16-year streak since that's happened. Now, they've had guys knocked out of games who didn't finish the game but came back and started the next game.
Right.
And they've had changes at quarterback that were unrelated to injury. But nobody has gotten hurt in a game and not started the next game. Sooner or later, it has to happen. And that speaks to luck. That speaks to some really tough quarterbacks, John Parker Wilson being one who probably should have missed a couple of starts and was just too tough to let that happen. And it comes to having good offensive lines, which especially under Saban, but even before.
Well, Jalen Hurts proved his toughness to me in Oxford. Was that 2016?
Yes.
When Marquise Haynes basically beheaded him.
Mm-hmm.
Dude didn't miss a play.
No, and he's done that, and I've seen some others do that. So there's some toughness factor there. It's not all luck. You got to have tough guys playing that. But sooner or later, you figure a starting quarterback gets hurt and misses significant time, and they haven't had to deal with that. So, presuming there is no such injury, I think Tua's the better quarterback, at least the one who can do more things. Now, Jalen's a winner and Jalen's a leader, and those are intangibles. His intangibles are off the chart. You talk to guys on the team, and they want to play for him. You know, I think they are a better team with him in some ways than they are without him, because you're going to get that 110% type effort from guys because they really want to win for him. And he made plays, you know, at LSU as a freshman in a game they won 10-0 and that's 0-0. And he made the plays that could have beat Clemson in the game they lost, where he, you know, having a tough time all night, getting nothing done, and he put some magical drive together. Because he's a lot of it's with his legs. He's not as good a passer. But I'll tell you something else. Jalen doesn't take a 16-yard loss on that first down in overtime. So he's got some qualities that you like to have. And I think they're both the kind of guy who's going to support the other as much as they want to play. And I think what you saw after the game was very genuine that I'm happy for the other guy, and you don't always get that.
That was my question. Is there a scenario where this becomes a divisive thing inside that team, inside that program?
We don't know. We'll have to see how that plays out. I'll tell you this. You know, history tells me that while Nick Saban may let a quarterback competition play out for several weeks, once he's decided who his starter is, he's a one quarterback guy. That's the way he is, and a lot of coaches are that way. And then some will try to be accommodating even when maybe they shouldn't. I think once he decides who the quarterback is and figures it has proven itself, you know, he did not hesitate to make Blake Sims his quarterback because he thought he was better than Jake Coker at that time, and he was. A lot of fans weren't on board with that, you know. This is a guy who played running back, fifth-year guy, never got above, you know, anywhere on the depth chart at anything, and then he wins the starting job, and well, that's Nick Saban says because he's the best quarterback on this team.
Quarterback notwithstanding, is this your typical Nick Saban Alabama team where it's stacked everywhere and beating them it requires a yeoman's effort from whoever?
Yes and no. The secondary is going to have to grow. You didn't just lose the four, you know, two corners and two safeties. You also lost your nickel and your dime. And guess what? They're all in the National Football League. The entire secondary is wiped out. There's only a couple of guys who played. So you got some freshmen. You got some guys who've been career backups. And you got to let that come together. It's going to be interesting because Louisville, in my opinion, is not going to beat Alabama. But Bobby Petrino is going to come out and throw it 45 times. And he's going to test that secondary. And Ole Miss, I don't think, is going to beat Alabama. But Ole Miss is going to come off the bus throwing. That's what they do. They may be leaning toward being a little less wide open than they were before. But they're going to try to beat Alabama through the air because it's the only way they can beat Alabama.
Sure.
And it's what they believe in. And if you look down the line, Auburn's got a really good quarterback and I think is a real threat to beat Alabama because if that secondary hasn't come together by game 12, Auburn can do something about that, presuming Stidham's healthy and still there because I think he's a very good quarterback. There's a couple of other spots. You know, this is the kind of year where A&M might have been better with a Sumlin-type attack to get Alabama fairly early in the year, fourth game. I think if Alabama's secondary is still finding its way, maybe that's a spot that type Sumlin attack, you know, 55, 60 passes might make something happen, but I don't think that's what they're going to try to do now. I think it all depends on the secondary because I think, you know, they lost their kicker, no big deal. They lost a great punter. I think you would agree he's probably the best punter over the last 4 years in the SEC, without question. And that's, you know, he's probably worth three first downs a game in field position every game that I saw him play, except for three or four never got to punt, but they've got to find, you know, they may have to get those three first downs now. I think this Alabama team is going to be a little more offense-minded. They've got weapons everywhere, and I think they'll have the best offensive line they've had in four or five years even, if everybody's healthy and it comes together like I think it will. And I think Alabama's going to pass first and run second if Tua's in, and the opposite if it's Jalen, and see how that plays out. I think it's going to be an Alabama team to some degree. You're going to have to outscore to beat.
You're also a guy that studies the rest of the league. A lot of new faces in the league. The West is a completely different picture.
I can't even name the head coaches. Yeah, give me to the end of the week so I'll see what they look like.
What do you expect out of the rest of the West? I mean, I think everyone generally believes it's Alabama and Auburn in some order at the top. But what do you expect after that?
I think it's a bit of a crapshoot. I think, you know, everybody for some reasons kind of put a lot on Mississippi State. They've got a good quarterback coming back, but and they're probably going to have a decent defense, but I don't know that they're all that. I think in a normal year, that would be a fourth place type team because LSU would be above them. But I think LSU is the one that I could see that crash and burn really bad and really hard. You know, I'll say this. You were in the room just a little while ago when Ed Orgeron was asked about changing his offensive coordinator after 1 year, just as he did at Ole Miss. And he said, it starts with making a mistake. And I almost raised my hand and said, you mean when they hired you? Because I think he's not any kind of long-term solution. The only reason, if they do what I think they're going to do, the only reason Ed Orgeron survives is because the athletic director doesn't survive unless Ed Orgeron survives. There's an anchor tied to your leg, and if you throw it overboard, you go with it if you're the AD. So I don't think they've got it. you're putting a lot on an Ohio State backup quarterback to be your savior. And, Neil, here's your trivia question. Who is the last quarterback that LSU recruited and developed that was a good quarterback starter? Is it Matt Flynn?
Or Jamarcus Russell?
Yeah. I mean, Matt Flynn was since Russell, and he's not quite what Russell was physically, but it's not under Les Miles, and it's not been under Ed Orgeron. I mean, Mettenberger was a good quarterback. He had a good arm.
But he was a transfer.
But he was not their guy. He's not the guy that they developed. And now they're trying to follow that formula again. It's amazing as much talent as there has been. We could go through a lot of names, but none of them panned out. Ryan Perilou might have been that guy, but not talk about your 10-cent head guy,
My theory on transfer quarterbacks, and this isn't always fair, but if Urban Meyer felt like Joe Burrow was a winning quarterback, he would find a way to keep him on the roster.
I think a lot of times, and I've seen some guys like this, I'll throw out the name Blake Barnett, who was at Alabama, was a five-star, Elite 11 superstar, who lost the starting job and didn't win the starting job, rather. Jalen got it, and he went and took his ball elsewhere, and then he took it somewhere else. I don't even know where he's at anymore. I've lost track. I think a lot of quarterbacks who are good coming out of high school, especially, who believe they're hype, are not good competitors. And when they're put in a situation where they got to win the job and compete every day, I'm not talking about competing on the field when you're in a game. I'm talking about competing for your spot like a running back has to do, like a center has to do, like a linebacker has to do. Some of them are not mentally geared to do that. And they just say, if I don't win it now, I'm not willing to stay around and try to win it back. And I don't have that mental makeup to persevere, and then when they transfer again, or they don't pan out because they go somewhere else and they got to compete.
I want to get your thoughts real quick on Georgia. You can't get any closer to a national title than they got without winning one. That's literally as close as you can get. They continue to recruit at a remarkably high level. It's basically Alabama East.
Mm-hmm. It's not Alabama Light. It's Alabama East.
In your eyes, is Georgia just absolutely on a collision course with another date at a chance at the title?
What, the national title? I don't think. Not this year, I don't think. I'd be a little surprised. Because the difference between this third-year Georgia under Kirby and third-year Alabama under Saban is everybody came back from the second year at Alabama. Julio came back. And you go down the line. Offensive line was basically back. The linebackers were back. And Georgia's got a lot of turnover there. They've got guys that went to the NFL, are going to be good NFL players, that the next guy may or may not be that. They may be a recruiting class or two away from that. They may not, and I may be surprised. But, you lost two great running backs. Is the new guy as good as those two, or is he just a good running back? Is it just one guy, or do you have two like you did last year, or three? I don't know if Holyfield's that guy to step in that role. Caven, or I forgot what, Riley Ridley.
Yeah.
I'm glad he didn't come to Alabama, because if there had been a Calvin and a Caven Ridley on the roster, I think I would have just quit. C. Ridley, But the other Ridley, the younger Ridley, had a good game against Alabama, but he didn't really live up to the hype. He didn't have the kind of freshman year that his brother had at Alabama, and the Julio Jones and the Amari Cooper type. Now, maybe he is all that, and he does that next year. But I don't see a receiver who's proven on that team that I could say, that's going to be the guy. I don't see a running back, or certainly a running back duo that I look at on that team, and a linebacker and all that I know that guy's back or as good as the guy before him. So Georgia will get there. They're going to be good because they're recruiting at a Saban-almost-like level. And so you're going to contend with them for years. And I think they will win the East, but I don't know that they're necessarily going to just walk through the East so that if they lose, the only game they lose is the SEC championship game.
Buy or sell Jeremy Pruitt at Tennessee?
I don't know. That program's in the dumps. That's a long-term rebuilding job. I think we've seen that, and I don't think they got a lick better under Butch. They talked about how they're recruiting was coming along. Go show me who those guys are, because I'm missing it. There's a player or two on that roster, but ain't a lot of players on that.
Every team in the league has a player or two.
Right, yeah, Kentucky's got some good players. Sure. Too. Josh Allen, he starts anywhere. He probably starts at Alabama. I mean, you know, there's guys like that somewhere. You know, Vandy's had linebackers who would start for anybody. Starting the NFL is good enough for me. But I don't see this recruiting that Tennessee did. I think it's all smoke and mirrors. So long-term, I think maybe he can get it done because I believe Jeremy's a recruiter too. He's not going to have a turnaround like Kirby did. And really, Kirby didn't take over a program that was in the shape that Tennessee's in. He took over a good program that was on the verge that never was going to get there under the previous coach, but wasn't that far away either. I mean, how many five-star quarterbacks has Georgia had? They've signed like 11 of them in the last 2 years, it seems like.
Yeah, he's just done a remarkable job recruiting, maybe a better job than anybody in the country, even including Alabama in the last 24 months.
I don't disagree. You know, I think they're a little neck and neck, but you could argue that he's done the better job.
All right, so last couple of things. I think you're picking Georgia to be in the SEC championship game. Do you anticipate it being Alabama or Auburn?
I anticipate it being Alabama almost by default because, gee, they weren't there last year. It's almost impossible to imagine them not being in it 2 years in a row. And because I think there's a lot of talent there. And I think ultimately this team is going to be able to score a lot of points on anybody, and it's going to be hard to beat them.
And last thing, and I feel like everybody always asks this question, I'm sure you get this question 100 times, is there any indication at all that Nick Saban, as he approaches 70, is even thinking about slowing down?
No, you know, I've heard, you know, rumblings or rumors a couple of times in off seasons, not this particular last one, that he might be getting close to it, and then he seems to get renewed. Nothing in his routine has changed in any way that makes you think, okay, he's starting to take his foot off the pedal. And I don't think he knows how to. And I think there's a little bit of that Bear Bryant, Joe Paterno, that keep coaching till you die, because if you don't keep coaching, you might not. I mean, that's what he lives for, you know.
Yeah.
The guy wants to do football 365 days a year. He wants to watch film on Christmas. Why wouldn't he? You know, okay, we'll open the presents and we'll eat the turkey. Now let me go watch film. That's the kind of guy he is. And there's really no better place in the world to do that, except perhaps Green Bay, Wisconsin, than Tuscaloosa, Alabama. That's what they do anyway, you know. So I think he wants to take this ride as far as he can take it. Now, if he has a health event or something, that can change that. But I don't see it in the next couple of years the way I'm seeing it. I just don't see – he went out and hired a bunch of young coaches to re-energize things. And I think he likes that because he's a guy who coaches as well as coaching players. And I think probably more coaches now than coaches players. You know, he was much more hands-on, say, with the secondary in Kirby's early tenure than he was later in Kirby's tenure. And I'm sure he steps in from time to time and lets his wishes be known and shows a guy how to do something and shows him how to do it pretty well. But I don't think he's day-to-day out there coaching technique with every player all the time. He coaches that technique and lets them teach it. I think as much as the people in Oxford and elsewhere would like to see Nick Saban go off to a nice retirement, send him some. I'm sure there's lots of people that would be happy to send him retirement gifts if he would go ahead and pack it in.
He'd get some great rocking chairs.
Exactly. I don't think it's going to happen in the next couple of years.
Tommy, thanks so much for the time and the insight. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Neil.
We take a break from the podcast to tell you that the podcast is brought to you in part by Billy's Pecans. Guests join us throughout the week on the Billy's Pecans hotline. Check out their selection of pecans. It's the cinnamon spice pecans are fantastic. My favorite, the toasted pecans. Simple, but you just can't beat them. Dark chocolate, white chocolate, chocolate amaretto, chocolate Grand Marnier, and more. They also have other things, all sorts of goodies. Pecans and chocolate, southern pecan toffee, cheese crispies, pecan brittle, coffee cakes, sauces, jellies, and more. All of that at Billy's Pecans. It's billyspecans.com or 1-800-624-7404. The podcast also brought to you by Oxford University Bank. OUB, locally owned and operated right here in Oxford. When you deposit money at OUB, that money and the vast majority of the bank's profits go right back into the Oxford community. OUB gives you the comfort of home, all the benefits the big mega banks provide, all the technology and products you can want, all with the personal touch. When you call OUB, you speak directly with a live person, all without having to press 10 buttons, all without that 5-minute wait. OUB offers its customers the absolute best cash checking account. It's called Kasasa. And with Kasasa, OUB will pay customers 2.5% interest on their balances up to $50,000. With Kasasa, ATM fees nationwide are refunded. Also, OUB offers online bill pay and mobile check deposit using its online app. To learn more about OUB, check out liveoxfordbankoxford.com or call 662-234-6668. OUB is FDIC insured. And the podcast is brought to you by 7 South Tailgating. 7 South celebrating 10 years of business this season. If you try 7 South Tailgating once, you'll never tailgate without them again. 7 South will set up your own personal gear, or you can rent everything from them. No one matches their customer service, their attention to detail. Whether you're coming up for one game, just all of the SEC games, or you're coming up for all of the games, and whether you have a very intricate tailgate or the simplest of tailgates, 7 South Tailgating can hook you up, make the process of tailgating in the Grove far more enjoyable than having to do it yourself. 7SouthTailgating.com. Now back to the Oxford Exxon podcast.
Thanks to Tommy for giving Neil a good bit of time there. Alabama again joining their day in the circus today on the first day of the SEC Media Days was Texas A&M. Jimbo Fisher making his SEC head coaching debut as well. So we'll jump right back into interviews now. We'll talk to Mark Passwaters, covering Texas A&M for the Rivals.com network, and we'll go to him now on the Billy Spokons hotline.
Mark Passwaters here with me for the podcast. Mark, Jimbo Fisher just talked. A lot of talk about national championships, and I know that's something that A&M and every other program wants to do, but man, when people start talking about national championships and putting a timetable on national titles, obviously, he's getting a ton of money. That's a ton of pressure. But still, it seems like those kind of conversations are, at least for now, kind of premature.
But it almost seems like people think there's an air of inevitability to it. But you're still in the SEC West. You're still kind of rebuilding a little bit. Yeah, you've got work that needs to be done in a very difficult and competitive conference. Now, he's made a lot of progress in a short period of time, at least off the field. But, you know, what is it really going to take? And I think that that's something that he's still trying to figure out. He seems pretty positive about his guys, but, you know, we'll see what happens when the rubber hits the road.
He's recruiting at a really high level, and that's where it all starts. What type of a roster did he actually inherit? You know it probably better than he does at this point. What did he inherit? How much work is there to be done? You've seen Alabama. You see the Auburns, the teams that have truly been title contenders and won titles. For the roster that he has, how much work is there to get to that place?
They have a lot of talent that has been poorly developed. And, yes, that is a direct comment on Kevin Sumlin and his coaching staff. You take a look at the 4- and 5-star guys they brought in, even the high 3-stars. If you look at across the rating services, they have very, very good football players on paper. And they have not shown the level of development that you would expect for a coaching staff that was paid the way the last one was. He has come in, he being Fisher, and has placed an emphasis on toughness. I think you saw that just in the conversation he had with the media there. I think that that's the biggest thing, is he wants these guys to go in there and realize that finesse is out the window. You have to be tough. If somebody hits you, you better be willing and ready to hit them back. Otherwise, you're just not flat going to win. And I think that that was painfully obvious to everybody but Kevin Sumlin, especially the way things went the last 3 or 4 years down the stretch. They were very good and very competitive early, but once the bumps and the bruises started to build up, they weren't nearly as competitive, and that's what has to change.
That wasn't someone's reputation going into A&M. What do you think led to that?
I think Kevin Sumlin got more interested in the Kevin Sumlin brand, the Yeser brand, than he was Texas A&M football. I think that he got cocky. He was always cocky, but he took it to another level. I think that he became smug and complacent, and that really hurt them. He's not a hands-on guy. He's a very hands-off guy, but he just almost got to the point where it looked like he was okay with okay. Fan base wasn't, especially the way he was being paid. So I think by the middle of last year, it was inevitable that a change was going to be made. It just was a question of how big a change it was going to be and how big a name they were going to get. And obviously, they got the biggest one that was available.
Give me the abridged version here. Offense, defense, what does this team look like?
That's a good question on offense because it's an entirely different scheme. I think they've got two very good quarterbacks. Either way, they can win with Nick Starkle or Kellen Mond. I have some questions about wide receiver, but they seem to be developing. I think Jamon Osborne is going to be very good. They have a young man named Jalen Preston coming in from Manville. That's a school that Ole Miss fans may be familiar with, Deontay Anderson. They have a lot of guys. I think they have nine receivers, nine scholarship receivers. So they're all sophomores, every single one. So there's options to be had. You have speed, you have size, all that. But nobody's really stepped to the forefront yet. They like their tight ends, which is something that you haven't heard at A&M a lot. A lot of good running backs. The big question is the offensive line. How good can they be? They really need to develop because they were not good last year. And a lot of those stained faces are still there. What's going to happen now if they're getting in a three-point stance, hand in the dirt, and not the two-point, you know, back and defend that someone had? Defensively, they look good on paper. You got a lot of depth at defensive tackle, maybe more than anywhere in the country. I like their starters at defensive end. If a couple of these very talented freshmen they have come in and can play some backup minutes, that would really be good. Terrell Dodson and Otero Alaka are very good linebackers. The safeties will be good. The corners position's the question. Who's going to play across from Charles Oliver? They have to figure that out. And obviously they've got to adapt to a new defensive scheme with Mike Elko. So it's going to be a question of how long it takes to adapt and where you can find a couple of guys to plug in certain positions.
Obviously the SEC West isn't – no one's standing still, certainly not at the top. Alabama's a defending national champ and probably a favorite to do it again. Auburn's very good. Arkansas's got a new coach. LSU's Ed Orgeron probably on the hot seat. Mississippi State should have a very good team. Ole Miss is in sort of a rebuild mode. In your opinion, where does sort of Texas A&M fit in that pecking order going into this year?
It's a great question. And if you look at the schools that we're talking about, they have the biggest question mark. They have, outside of Alabama, they may have the highest ceiling, but they could also be a 500 team. It really depends on how quickly some of these players that Fisher has develop. You know, he was talking about how he likes the buy-in from the players. That's a positive sign. But the offensive linemen have to block better. The corners have to play better, you know, defensively. They've got to get up on guys and, you know, really play physical and tough. They need to run the football, and they need to figure out who their quarterback is and stick with it.
He was asked about timetable for a championship, which is an impossible question to answer. How long does he have from a fan base before they get itchy?
Well, I think there are some guys that are itchy right now, just looking at the price tag. I think he's probably got 3 or 4 years before people really start to, you know, really get concerned or frustrated. You know, he's got to rebuild not just a program, but he's got to rebuild a mindset. And that may be the most difficult thing. You know, you take a look at A&M and when they had success, you know, it was Johnny Manziel, you know, throwing the ball all over the place. And some people thought, well, that's the Sumlin system. Well, it ended up it was Johnny Manziel. You know, there are certain ways that works. Certain times it was successful in the SEC. But as time went on, people adapted, and he didn't. You know, the soft mindset, the lack of physicality, all those things are true. And I think everybody knows that. So Fisher is out there preaching toughness. You just heard it as well as anybody. You know, that's his thing. You know, if his team is tough, then he thinks they'll win. If they're not tough enough, then they're not.
He has so many Nick Saban mannerisms. Watching him walk, just even the way that he talks now, some of the things that he said, it's obvious he learned a lot from him. Do you anticipate that, much like Kirby Smart has done at Georgia, it's almost trying to put the, for lack of a better term, the Alabama system into College Station?
Well, he definitely believes in his program, and I think that his program bears a lot of similarities to what Nick Saban has. And, you know, if there's one to imitate, that's not a bad one.
Right.
You know, he has the skins on the wall, you know, for lack of a better term. He's won at the highest level. He's got a national championship. I think that one thing that was very obvious early on was not only does Fisher have a clue, but he has a roadmap that he's following. I don't think that A&M has had a coach that has had something like that. As long as I've covered him, Franchione, Sherman, Sumlin especially, you know, those guys had an idea, but they didn't have a real plan. They were kind of more read and react. This guy is going to apply his pressure to everybody else, not let them pressure him, and then A&M has to react in turn, if that makes any sense at all.
Last thing, someone put a gun to your head, said you had to kind of pick the record. You had one game either way. Where would you go?
Right now, I think they're in Sumlinville. They're probably an 8-4 football team. Really, if you take a look at it, it's going to be very difficult to beat Clemson, obviously, week two. Alabama, at Alabama, is going to be tough. The two games where it could really go, you know, you win one of these two games, you're moving up. At Mississippi State, where they have had fits, or at Auburn, which is a very good football team. You win either of those, your ceiling gets really high. You know, the one that everybody wants is LSU. And maybe that's the game that could be the most important, because those two teams are probably going to be there around 3 or 4, maybe 4 and 5, depending on Mississippi State. You win that game, it could be a real boost for A&M, and that could be the end for Orgeron. So that may be the most intriguing one of the bunch. But I think if you can win at Auburn or you can win at Mississippi State, that's a state.
Mark, thanks for the time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, bud.
We take a break from the show to tell you that the podcast is brought to you by Gambrell and Associates. Gambrell and Associates have 3 attorneys with more than 60 years of combined experience and more than 45 years handling only bankruptcy and Social Security disability claims. Check out their site, msbnkr.com, or by searching for Robert Gambrell on superlawyers.com or avvo.com. Super Lawyers only selects the top 5% of lawyers in the state, so you know you're getting a great one when you get Robert Gambrell. Gambrell and Associates handle Social Security disability claims statewide and in Memphis. For more information, call the office in Hernando at 662-342-7700 or in Oxford at 662-281-8800. The podcast is also brought to you by Grenada Nissan. If you're in the market for a Nissan vehicle, look no further than Grenada Nissan. Grenada Nissan has a complete selection of new and previously owned Nissan vehicles. Great lease deals as well. Go in, test drive one today. Tell Gene and Sandy that you heard about Grenada Nissan on the podcast or at rebelgrove.com. You'll get Rebel savings on top of the already great deals at Grenada Nissan. It's GrenadaNissanUSA.com. Podcast also brought to you by Harry Alexander. Harry is an Oxford-based RE/MAX Legacy Realty agent. He's been in Oxford more than 4 decades, and no one knows the residential and condo market better than Harry does. If you are in the market for a home or a condo in or around Oxford, go to his site, harryalexander.com, click on the Properties and Neighborhoods tab, filter through by what you're looking for. The results that you see are updated daily, and then you just send Harry an email. He'll take care of the rest, ha@harryalexander.com. And Rebel Nation, 2018 is the year of the fan. Ole Miss Athletics wants to showcase your stories and recognize you, the Ole Miss fan base. Exciting prizes and experiences throughout the year will be featured on omyearofthefan.com and updated often, so be sure to visit omyearofthefan.com. Now back to the Oxford Exxon podcast.
Thanks to Mark as well. We'll have more interviews coming later in the week. Who else have you talked to this point, Neil, that we might get tomorrow?
Talked to Scott Rabelais of the Advocate in Baton Rouge, talked about LSU. It was a pretty interesting conversation with him. And then who else did I talk to?
That's right.
Josh Kendall of the State. Kendall talked about South Carolina, who I'm high on. I've talked to some other people who they're high on them too. So I don't feel like a complete idiot.
You're year two into being really high on Boom and the Gamecocks.
Yeah, I think he fits there. And I told that to Josh and he said, you're right. I think his work ethic kind of mentality matches South Carolina better than it did Florida. And I think he learned from some things at Florida. And there's a lot of Matt Luke. There's a lot of Will Muschamp and Matt Luke. A lot of Matt Luke and Will Muschamp. Similar people. If you're an Ole Miss fan, you in my opinion, you kind of got to if you want to see Matt Luke succeed at Ole Miss, a little part of you should also probably want to see Will Muschamp succeed at South Carolina, because they're going to do it in pretty similar ways. They come from the same general bedrock, if you will. There's a lot of similarities between those two.
And they've shot ideas off each other. I mean, personality-wise, they know each other. Yeah, all the way up and down.
You know, Will wanted to hire Matt. There's a Kurt Roper connection there. There's some real similarities between those two. Very level-headed. I know that Will gets the reputation for the screaming and the yelling on the sideline and stuff, but his day-in, day-out personality is pretty similar to what I've seen from Matt Luke over the years.
Go ahead.
Pretty steady, intense, but steady.
I'm just scrolling Twitter a little bit. Joe Moorhead currently at the podium at SEC Media Days. The only subtle Ole Miss mention to this point is Moorhead gave a comment that his goal is to be the, quote, best Power 5 team in the state. But that's the only thing we've got so far from Moorhead.
And that's fine. I mean, it should be.
Well, of course, yeah.
You know, look, if you're Mississippi State, your path to success –
Why the Power 5 designation? Why that adjective? Oh,
if anything, that's a little jab at Southern Miss.
Okay. Think so?
A little bit. And I don't know why anybody's taking jabs at Southern Miss. They don't count. you know, but yeah, if you're Mississippi State, your path to success includes beating Ole Miss. And if you're Ole Miss, your path to success, absolutely. Listen, I've said this for 10 years. If you're Ole Miss, your path to being a power of any sort includes dominating your non-league conference. It includes dominating Vanderbilt. When you play Vanderbilt 10 times, you win at least 8 of those games. And frankly, Chase, it means winning 7 or 8 out of every 10 Egg Bowls. That's what it means. To be if you tell me that, hey, in 10 years Ole Miss is a national contender, I would tell you that would mean that they dominated Vanderbilt and have come very close to dominating Mississippi State in the series.
Little baseball news here with an Ole Miss connection. Everybody's been following the Manny Machado sweepstakes. Looks like he's headed to the Dodgers for at least a rental, and Errol Robinson caught up in this deal. Errol Robinson, currently the number 18 prospect for Los Angeles. He joins Diaz and Dustin May as the guys going to the Orioles in exchange for Manny Machado.
Yeah. Isn't Errol from Maryland?
He is, yeah. He's from Boyd, Maryland. He went to high school at, I think, a private school in D.C., but yeah, he's definitely from that area.
So he's getting closer to home and the path to the
much big easier.
it's a clear, much clearer path than he would have in Los Angeles. It's the Dodgers. The rumor is it's 5 prospects. It's the Dodgers' acknowledgement that the window might be closing.
Amps up the pressure, some boy.
It amps up the pressure on the Cubs, the Nationals. The losers here are the Phillies and the Brewers. They thought they had deals for Machado. They didn't get him. If you're the Cubs now, you've got a 2.5 game lead, but you've got to sit down and say, okay, what do we do to not match that, but if indeed those 2 teams are headed for their 3rd straight NLCS. Do you have the pitching to navigate that lineup? Do you pull the trigger on a blockbuster for Jacob deGrom or Noah Syndergaard? Those are questions that it'll be fascinating to see the answers. Today's the 18th. There's 13 days till the trade deadline. It'll be 13 pretty interesting days. And then, Chase, have you ever seen an organization have a worse 7 days than the Milwaukee Brewers?
Between on-field and off-field?
They go 1-7 on a road trip. They lose out in the Machado sweepstakes. And this situation with Josh Hader, their all-star reliever who has been phenomenal this season. I don't know how I really feel about it, honestly. But those tweets and the backlash, and at the very least, I'll be – two things. One, I will
help people out that haven't followed this. Give me a synopsis.
Well, last night during the Major League Baseball All-Star game, shortly after he gave up a three-run home run to Gene Segura of the Mariners, some tweets of Josh Hader's from 7 years ago began to surface. One was they were homophobic, they were racist. Some used the N-word. One citing lyrics from others, unfortunately for Josh Hader, were not from rap songs. They were hateful tweets, and someone had gone back and found them and waited for that moment and threw them out there. So it was some form of vengeance.
If you are any semblance of a public figure, clean up your digital footprint. I mean, look, this is not about, I mean, look, Hader, these tweets are despicable. I'm not saying that, but just in general, I mean, Ryan Rollison gets caught up in this from something when he was like 14 years old or something. I mean, clean it up one way or the other. I mean,
yeah, it's
becoming so much more mainstream for people to go back years and years and years and years and have ammunition. Now, obviously, don't allow ammunition. Don't do stupid things. I get that. That's primary. But I mean, there's some things that aren't even that major over the years that have become big deals because of just the digital footprint surviving.
Does Major League Baseball have to do something?
I mean, that's a larger conversation because, and I find myself being a little hypocritical here. My general thought is I hate when leagues punish for off-field behavior. I don't necessarily like them being the police in that manner. But yeah, I mean, this is something that's directly related to your PR as a major league organization.
It's a really tough spot for Major League Baseball. If he had made these tweets yesterday, it's easy.
Of course.
But he didn't. He made these tweets
when he was nowhere near a representative of Major League Baseball.
Yeah, he was not an employee of a Major League Baseball club when he made these tweets, and he was 17. Now, I'm the father of a 17-year-old, and she's smart enough not to do anything like that. But I'm sure that even my daughter, as kind of laid back and pretty straight-laced as she is, I'm sure she has done things in the last calendar year that she would not want used against her 7 or 8 years from now. I don't know how, but the language is in those tweets is so vile and so nasty. And the environment that we live in today, it is at the very least going to be a distraction in their clubhouse. And at the very most, it's going to force Major League Baseball's hand. And I don't know how they'll react to it. And I got to be honest, I'm sure as hell glad that I'm not the guy that has to figure out what to do or not to do there. There's some people in New York that today this is not the way they wanted to start their day as they figure out how they handle this and the backlash from it. And when the Brewers reconvene tomorrow, the media circus that will fall on Milwaukee, there are national baseball writers who did not intend to be in Milwaukee this weekend who will be. And they will be working one story, and it's.
What is there really to work though? I mean, you're right, but I mean, the guy was 17 at the time. I'm not justifying, and I'm just laying out the full picture here.
Sure.
I give him credit, or whomever credit that did this, the Brewers. He was decisive, quick with a response, a very thorough apology reading here last night, 9 hours ago. He said, there's no excuse for what was said. I'm deeply sorry for what I've said. It doesn't reflect any of my beliefs going on now. I was young, immature, and stupid. And there's no excuses for what was said or what happened. We're still learning who we are in high school. You live and you learn. The mistake won't happen again. He goes on to say, he's got a teammate that said, at the end of the day, you got to give people a second chance. You understand you have to forgive people, move on from it. For me, it's over and done with. He said it. It got out there. I'm moving on from it individually anyway.
That was Lorenzo Cain.
That was Lorenzo Cain, yes.
Yeah, who's one of the really good guys in all of Major League Baseball. In this case, it is probably worth noting that he's an African-American.
The last two quotes here, Hader goes on to finish, I'm ready for any consequences for what happened 7 years ago. And then Cain finished up with, that's one reason why I don't have social media for things like this. You always get in trouble for things you said when you were younger.
A lot of truth to that. I mean, it's amazing. I don't know what happens. I watched it unfold last night. We were up taping Greatest Pod in the South late. Literally, I kind of got in the bed as the game was ending, and that story was beginning to really pop. And it was you knew that was an all-star game that went extra innings and had 10 home runs. That was the story. What should have been a really good night for Major League Baseball, that was the story. They're not waking up happy in New York today.
Close here, because we've talked about this a lot. I sent you the information yesterday discussing marketing. For Major League Baseball, it's been a topic on our show for years, pretty much. We've talked to Walker Jones about it, who markets Bryce Harper and different Major League players. Quoting here, Mike Trout, number one player in baseball, no doubt, most successful, scored a 22 in Q Scores awareness category, which means a little more than 1 in 5 Americans even know who he is. The closest NBA player to Trout in terms of awareness among the general population per Q Scores research is reserve forward Kenneth Farid, who was traded by the Denver Nuggets to the Brooklyn Nets last week in a salary dump, blah, 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 blah.
Kenneth Farid.
Okay, so whatever. People, yeah. Okay. Point being served here, I think. Basically, the number one player in Major League Baseball is as likely to be seen and noticed on the street as a guy who averaged 14.4 minutes last season in the NBA. Rob Manfred, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, goes on yesterday to blame Mike Trout, saying he would be an even bigger star if he would spend more time marketing himself, something that Trout said he does as much as he can and definitely disagreed with Manfred's assessment.
Rob Manfred blamed Mike Trout.
That's what I want to do. Is the commissioner of a sport that's having a hard time getting publicity. I'm gonna pick a fight with the best player in my game.
I love Major League Baseball. I go to games. I watch a ton of games. I love the product. It's fantastic.
Here are the quotes on this real quick, just to not cut you off. Player marketing requires one thing for sure, the player, Manfred said. You cannot market a player passively. You can't market a player anything passively. You need people to engage with those to whom you are trying to market in order to have effective marketing. We are very interested in having our players more engaged and having higher profile players and helping our players develop their individual brands. But that involves the player being actively engaged. Mike's a great, great player and really nice person, but he's made certain decisions about what he wants to do and what he doesn't want to do and how he wants to spend his free time and how he doesn't want to spend his free time. That's up to him. If he wants to engage and be more active in that area, I think we can help make his brand really, really, really big. But he has to make a decision that he's prepared to engage in that area. It takes time and effort. Trout says, yeah, .. No. I keep telling you guys, I do as much as I can, but it's a long baseball season. I got to pick and choose what I want to do, things, and go from there.
Yeah, I would buy Manfred's comments if there was any baseball player. any baseball player who was as big of a international star as 30 NBA players. It's inexcusable. It's changed. Major League Baseball has not owned the young people. They don't watch. They're disinterested. They are more into the NBA. You and I talked about this yesterday, just having a conversation. No matter what you feel, the podcast listener, feel about the NBA, you have to admit that from the moment the NBA playoffs start until game whatever of the finals, the NBA owns the sports world. They do it in a phenomenal way. Whether you love the NBA or hate the NBA, you have no choice but to agree with that statement, because it's absolutely not debatable. Other than a few days where the NFL has the NFL draft steals the headlines for a few days. The NBA playoffs are marketed in a manner that make them headline news. Major League Baseball has not figured out how to do that. Major League Baseball doesn't even get good postseason ratings. The games are too long. The games start too late. That Major League Baseball All-Star game last night started after 8 o'clock in Washington, D.C. Why? The ratings are not good. The ratings for the Home Run Derby the other night, which was a really entertaining spectacle, were down from the year before. And Bryce Harper was in it. Javi Baez was in it. But along to the point, the person that beat Javi Baez, Max Muncy. Max Muncy could walk the streets of Oxford, Mississippi, and I don't think one soul would recognize him, with the possible exception of your brother, who's a Dodgers fan. That's it. How many recognizable baseball players are there? Meanwhile, the NBA is full of recognizable players because they've been marketed on social media, everywhere. They're just more active. Russell Westbrook plays in Oklahoma City, Chase. He's never won a championship. He's a one-time MVP. Now, he does a great job of branding himself. He's terrific at it. But he's on the cover of international magazines routinely. He has a brand that the NBA helps him embrace, that NBA embraces. The crazy clothes and the sunglasses and the way that he plays the game and all of that stuff. That's a guy that's never won a title, and he plays in a very small market.
Yeah, it's that deal where baseball should and has to be better, and then there's also a sliding scale here a little bit. It's not really taken up for baseball, but you have basketball where small roster sizes, only five people on the court, and the player impacts every single game. I mean, you mentioned this the other day, the game you went to, Mike Trout, 1-for-3 with a stolen base. He was kind of just like any other dude. Russell Westbrook's never going to be just like any other dude on the court when the viewer is watching. You know what I mean? So it's that deal, yeah, where you've got to be creative and different if you're baseball, because you're never going to impact every single game. The season's long. You're not really close to the action unless you've got seats down by the dugout. But you got to be better. There's got to be a way to make this thing more relatable, like, frankly, past generations, when I know lots have changed. But, I mean, at one point, baseball was the highest profile sport in this country.
Yeah, when I was a kid, it was.
Yeah.
And now, last weekend, the Major League Baseball game of the week, and I can't remember who it was, the Saturday night game, got a lower rating among, I think it was men 20 to 49 or something like that, 20 to 45, 19 to 45, whatever, got a lower rating than the World Cup consolation game where I think Belgium beat England. Obviously a lower rating than the World Cup final, which, by the way, was played on a Sunday morning. Started at 11 a.m. Eastern, so 8 a.m. on the West Coast. If you were in Los Angeles, San Francisco, that game began at 8 a.m. between Croatia and France. and it got a lower rating than a regular season Major League Soccer game between Atlanta United and Seattle. You can spend all you want. And I love baseball. You know that. I watch it. Spend all you want. That's a problem. Stadiums are emptier. Ratings are down. Again, spend all you want. There's two big trades in sports today. Manny Machado to the Dodgers. And Kawhi Leonard and DeMar DeRozan being swapped by San Antonio and Toronto. Which of those trades do you think will dominate the airwaves?
Well, there's no doubt it's going to be the basketball trade.
And the basketball season does not – camps don't even start till September. Baseball, Manny Machado will be wearing a Dodger uniform Thursday. He's impacting a sport that is – in its middle of its season right now, and the basketball trade will dominate the airwaves. And there's a reason for that. It's because the people that are putting together the programming, television and radio, have the analytics in front of them. And they're telling their people talk about basketball because more people are listening. And if you're baseball, that's a problem.
Last thing here, meant to speak about it a little earlier and just kind of forgot. Ole Miss came out and confirmed Russell's report that Didi Bui had left the program. The athlete headed to Northeast. Russell says to go JUCO ball and probably try to play wide receiver. That was never going to happen here at Ole Miss. Found Matt's the second sentence of his comment interesting. We have supported Didi every step of the way and wish him the best as he moves forward. Bottom line, you can't prop people up. At some point, they've got to take responsibilities for their own actions. They have to meet their own requirements, and it's pretty obvious and pretty known that DD has not done that since being on campus.
Yeah, and if you can't read between those lines, can't help you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, not all 105 roster members are the same.
No, and programs have rules. And those rules, the programs do their very best to help people comply. But there does come a point where you're accountable.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, all right, more guests throughout the week on the Billy's Pecans Hotline. Thanks to Tommy D's. Thank you to Mark Passwaters. And we will talk to you again tomorrow.